You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, powerful new antibiotics discovered using artificial intelligence.
We went into the laboratory, screened 7,500 chemicals against Acinetobacter. So basically what it looked like, instead of having to spend 3 weeks, let's say, or a month in the laboratory testing those 7,000 chemicals, we could train a model, push go, go to lunch, and come back, and then we had our predictions for us.
Sitting in a restaurant, staring at a piece of fish, is it really that expensive kind? Pull out your DNA barcode reader and find out.
Well, that's the dream, having a Star Trek tricorder for sure. I could very well imagine this kind of device as a plug-in or an add-on to a smartphone. It does the laboratory part, but the computer in the phone does the rest. Connect to a database like ours, get the species name back, and display it on the phone.
And sex and the brain. Women's and men's are wired differently. Men's brains are sexualized before they're born.
The male brain has undergone a sexual differentiation, which the female brain does not undergo to the same extent in utero. So more chemical, physiological changes have happened, and if something should go wrong, it could affect the male brain more than the female brain.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before launching in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. It's a staggering statistic. COVID has killed almost 7 million worldwide. The number is likely higher. Meanwhile, a potentially deadlier pandemic sweeps the planet. Bacterial infections antibiotics can't cure. According to one UK government study, by 2050, 10 million may die every year, infected by multi- or pan-resistant microbes that no drug will kill. Drug resistance is the inevitable result of antibiotic overuse or misuse. To treat viral infections, for example, what doesn't kill infectious bacteria makes them stronger. So, science searches for new drugs that do work. The trouble is, Big Pharma is not interested. There's no profit to be made developing drugs that will end up on the top shelf, reserved for emergencies when no other drug will work. Big Pharma wants to produce drugs that billions will use all the time. Precisely how antibiotics can't be used, or else they'd become useless. So, academic researchers are picking up the slack. At McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, a team of scientists are screening thousands of hopeful candidates, totally new kinds of antibiotics that bugs have never seen and are unlikely to become resistant to. And for hot tips, they're turning to artificial intelligence, neural networks, and machine learning. John Stokes is an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biomedical Sciences at McMaster University. What is it that has led researchers such as yourself to artificial intelligence and deep learning and machine learning and discovering new drugs?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and one that we quite frankly think about all the time too. When we embark on any antibiotic discovery project, we are what I'll call tool agnostic. You know, our end goal is to find new medicines to make sick people not sick. Whatever set of tools will get us there most efficiently is what we're going to use. In the context of AI, we consider these algorithms as suggestion generation boxes. So in a conventional antibiotic discovery, a wet lab scientist goes into the laboratory and they might be able to screen a million molecules for some new antimicrobial chemical matter, let's say. But you can imagine, you know, if let's say I want to kill Klebsiella, I have a million chemical library, I have to do a million experiments. right? To find the molecule that might do the thing I want it to do. There's a ton of laboratory automation that goes into this, but it's still, if I have a million chemicals, I have to run a million individual little experiments, right? And that's super time consuming and expensive too, because consumables, you know, the dishes, for example, in which we grow these bacteria are not cheap. The acquisition of the chemicals to screen is not cheap. And what we often find too, in a lot of these chemical libraries that we can purchase and assemble in the laboratory, the chemical diversity that's often explored is not as vast as one would hope. So the question becomes, how can we improve upon this conventional laboratory screening process? And, you know, I'm a proponent of the use of ML to help us, you know, increase the rate at which we can discover new antibiotics.
Machine learning.
Yeah, machine learning. So the first thing that we have to do to train an ML model, machine learning model, is gather training data. We'll go into the laboratory and screen, let's say, maybe 10,000 chemicals against a bacterium of interest. So we'll go into the laboratory, collect a diverse collection of about 10,000 chemicals, test all 10,000 of those, and then we can identify which chemicals are antibacterial and which ones are not. Because we know the structures of all the chemicals, as well as their associated antibioticness, if we want to call it that, we can now train a machine learning model to understand chemical features associated with antibioticness and chemical features that are not associated with this antibacterial activity. And then once we have this trained model, we can then start showing it millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions even, of brand new chemicals in silico in the computer. And what it's going to do is tell us whether it thinks each chemical might be antibacterial or not based on its chemical structure.
And when you talk about the chemical structure, you're talking about its three-dimensional shape.
Yeah, so we're talking about atomic interconnectivity. So what the machine is learning, what the model is learning, are how all the atoms are connected to every other atom in a molecule, and how the atomic interconnectivity of every molecule is associated with its antibacterial activity. And it's learning, you know, with the types of models that we often employ, often very subtle features that would be quite tricky for us as humans to pick up by eye.
In other words, whether or not there's a kink in the molecule somewhere, or it's got a curious spot on its surface area.
It could be one or more of many different types of features. What's kind of interesting about all this is we actually don't know what they're seeing. You'll often hear deep learning. That's machine learning using neural networks as the model architecture. That's called deep learning. So you'll often hear deep learning models colloquially called black boxes, because we feed input data. It does a bunch of stuff. It extracts features from that data and then gives us an output. But what it's extracting, we actually don't know.
And what's a neural network?
So a neural network is a type of artificial intelligence algorithm that takes inspiration from neuronal interconnectivity of the brain. You have an input layer that takes a whole bunch of data, and then a whole bunch of these things called hidden layers that are responsible for processing the input data and extracting relevant features. And then you have an output layer that is what the human then interprets. So the output layer might be quantifying antibioticness on a scale from 1 to 0.
And so you feed in 10,000 structures, which you've analyzed empirically in the lab.
Yep.
Using
Yep.
automation. And you say, you know, these work, these don't work. These are kind of about halfway. And you feed that in. And the neural network comes back at you with what, like 200 best shots?
So after we've trained our model, let's say we train our model on 10,000 chemicals. So what that's going to do during the training process is the model is learning all of the chemical features associated with antibioticness, and then all the features that are not. So then let's say that's 10,000 chemicals worth of training data. Well, now we can show it, you know, hundreds of millions quite easily of brand new chemicals it has never seen before. And then based on what it learned during training, it's going to take that input structure, that new structure of a chemical that it's never seen before, extract the relevant features from it that it learned during training, and then spit out a number between 0 and 1.
And some of these chemical structures, molecules that you're feeding in are already pharmaceuticals that are used to treat whatever, hair loss, for example, or urinary dysfunction.
Yeah, they can be any molecule. They can be preclinical, clinical stuff no one's ever looked at before. It can be any chemical. And then the model, based on what it learned during training, will tell us whether it thinks it's antibacterial or not. And what's really cool, these neural network architectures, like I just described, are becoming sufficiently powerful, sufficiently sophisticated to extract a lot of really complex features from chemicals in a way that I think can meaningfully influence how we make empirical decisions, laboratory decisions. So going back to my suggestion generation box, let's say we run predictions using our trained model on 100 million chemicals. 100 million experiments in the laboratory is infeasible. It would take probably a decade to do that many wet lab experiments, testing 100 million molecules. You know, but we can run predictions on 100 million molecules in a few days. Fine. And what it's going to do is it'll allow us to look at all the chemicals that it thinks could be antibacterial. So it's making a whole bunch of suggestions for us, right? It's saying, here's 100 million chemicals. I only think you should really pay attention to these 1,000, right? So it's making 1,000 suggestions for us. Then we, as the wet lab scientist, the person who's going to eventually do the experiment, can then look at those 1,000 suggestions, strongly predicted antibiotics, and then say, okay, which one of these 1,000 or which dozen, whatever, of these 1,000 am I going to test in the laboratory?
And the interesting thing that listeners should know is that antibiotics today, and for the last, since antibiotics were discovered 100 years ago, the first one, all of them, they all belong to maybe 5 or 6 different classes of structure. They're 5 or 6 types of molecules, like, you know, the penicillins and cephalosporins are beta-lactam drugs, and the folate inhibitors have this shape. There's only about 6 classes. So this process you're describing is going to be spinning off potential drugs that belong to totally different structural classes that have bear no resemblance to any of the known structural classes of antibiotics.
Precisely. And the important, I'll say, machine learning feature in order to get us to these new structural and therefore functional classes of antibiotics is the ability of the model to, quote, generalize. So what that means is we're training the model on one set of chemicals, you know, that live in a defined chemical space, let's say. But when we're looking for structurally and functionally new molecules, we tell that model, okay, we want you to look in some brand new chemical space for antibiotic, for antimicrobial chemical matter, right? And that process of generalizing to brand new chemicals that are divergent from those that were used during training is something, you know, that has relatively recently been robust. And I'd say that, you know, we're within the last 5-6 years, something like that.
Tell me about Acinetobacter baumannii and why you chose it as a target for developing a group of potential antibiotics to treat it. Like, why Acinetobacter baumannii?
So I've had, a casual interest in Acinetobacter for a long time now, like maybe 10 years, like since my mid-grad school days. And I find it really fascinating for a number of reasons. First, it's a hospital-acquired infection. It's a hospital-acquired pathogen. And that's where you find Acinetobacter baumannii, is in hospital settings. You don't find it out in nature very much. Now, the problematic features of Acinetobacter is that it's hard to remove from surfaces. You'll find it on doorknobs and hospital equipment. It's really hard to strip. And the other interesting feature of Acinetobacter that makes it a problematic pathogen is its ability to uptake and just kind of hold on to extracellular DNA. And you'd imagine if you're a bacterium living in a hospital, a lot of that extracellular DNA is going to encode antibiotic resistance genes. So it's really common to find multi-drug resistant, extensively drug resistant, and pan-drug resistant isolates of Acinetobacter.
These are superbugs.
Yeah, perhaps the superest of superbugs.
And they have these pumps. They have multifunctional pumps that pump out this antibiotic and that antibiotic and the other antibiotic. Tell me about that.
Antibiotic efflux, that's the process of pumping out molecules, is common amongst, you know, clinical pathogens. It's exactly what it sounds like. An antibiotic molecule will make it into the cell. And then bacteria that are expressing these efflux pumps will just take that molecule and pump it right back out. So you actually never get enough antibiotic molecule into the cell for it to do the thing to kill the bacteria.
And Acinetobacter baumannii is really good at this.
I'd say it's really good at every type of resistance, whether we're talking about efflux or enzymatic modification of the antibiotic, enzymatic modification of the target to which the antibiotic normally binds. You know, there are many mechanisms through which resistance can emerge, and I don't want to speak too generally, but I would bet that Acinetobacter does all of it.
And what kind of infections does Acinetobacter cause? And do people die of these?
Oh, yeah. So it causes a diverse array of infections, too. It's quite virulent. So you can get things like pneumonia and meningitis, bacteremia, so blood infections, wound infections. And, you know, estimates put mortality at 1 in 4.
1 in 4 people who come down in the hospital with Acinetobacter infections die.
About that, yeah. Yeah. It's like no joke.
And how are they treated? What antibiotics are used to treat Acinetobacter?
I can't recall first-line treatments, but I know for like drug-resistant strains, colistin is one that they'll often use. And colistin is a useful antibiotic, but it comes with a whole host of side effects. A big one being nephrotoxicity.
The toxicity to the kidneys.
Yep.
And colistin is the drug of last resort.
It's the last resort antibiotic, yeah.
And are there colistin-resistant strains of Acinetobacter floating around?
Oh, sure.
That's the scary stuff.
Yeah, there are isolates of Acinetobacter that are resistant to every clinically used antibiotic we currently have. And over time, the number of clinical isolates of Acinetobacter that are resistant to every antibiotic we have is just going to grow.
Tell me about a Bowson.
So we set out to leverage machine learning to discover new antibiotics against Acinetobacter. And as we were discussing earlier, one of the criteria for when we look for new molecules is that they have to be structurally divergent from any other clinical antibiotic we have. And that's for an obvious reason, and it's to avoid, you know, being able to overcome, let's say, pre-existing resistance determinants. So how we went about discovering this molecule is we went into the laboratory, screened 7,500 chemicals against Acinetobacter, just looking for which ones could inhibit growth, which ones wouldn't. We trained a model on those chemicals, and then we started to run predictions on a relatively modest in silico chemical collection. So we only ran predictions on something like 7,000 chemicals in the computer. And we could have probably screen those 7,000 molecules in the laboratory. It would have taken about 3 weeks, maybe a month, let's say. But for perspective, our model was able to assess those 7,000 chemical structures in about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So basically what it looked like, instead of having to spend 3 weeks, let's say, or a month in the laboratory testing those 7,000 chemicals, we could train a model, push go, go to lunch and come back. And then we had our predictions for us.
And how big is the computer that is used to do this?
So we have access at McMaster. Our lab is super fortunate. We have access to a GPU cluster, graphics processing unit cluster, that we often do all of our neural network training and predictions on. But with a model this size, the one that we used to discover that narrow spectrum Acinetobacter molecule, that could be done on a laptop.
It could be done on a laptop. It's amazing. Yeah. So tell me about a Bowson. What is this molecule? It's a narrow spectrum drug. Talk about this. It's important. Like narrow spectrum drugs are like precision guided bullets that are less likely to generate resistance. So tell me about a Bowson.
So when we came across this molecule, we tested it in the laboratory. The model said test this, so we did. And we observed that it had, you know, a reasonable, I would say actually a pretty good MIC, minimum inhibitory concentration. So that's the lowest concentration of drug that it takes to inhibit the growth of a bacterium in a dish. About 2 micrograms per milliliter. And that puts it roughly in the ballpark of other clinical antibiotics for Acinetobacter. So we're like, that's great. Let's continue studying this. And one of the experiments we often do is just test the spectrum in which the molecule could work. So we take a whole bunch of different clinical isolates from a bunch of different species, and say, what is the spectrum of activity? And most antibiotics are what are known as broad spectrum, meaning that they inhibit the growth of a really wide phylogenetic spectrum of bacterial species. When we tested this compound, Abacin, against a whole bunch of different bacterial species, we observed it didn't work. It only worked against isolates of Acinetobacter. And even at really high concentrations, it wasn't working against, you know, Enterobacteriaceae or Pseudomonas aeruginosa or Staphylococcus aureus. So when we observed this, you know, we actually, we just decided to focus on this molecule. We could have very easily continued to run predictions, right? That we were planning, we were expecting to have to run a lot of predictions. But when we came across this molecule that was potent and had narrow spectrum Acinetobacter activity, we decided to put all of our effort into this chemical because it was just such an odd, you know, it's a unique phenotype. Narrow spectrum activity is not common. So when we saw this, we knew we had something cool.
And the best drugs are narrow spectrum, all other things being equal, because they're only targeting one thing. And so if that thing develops resistance, it does. But other things that you're not even targeting, they don't develop resistance because you're not targeting them.
Exactly. So broad spectrum antibiotics impose a universal selective pressure across, you know, an entire ecological niche. So it promotes the horizontal dissemination of antibiotic resistance genes, like really rapidly. But if you have a targeted narrow spectrum antibiotic, you no longer are imposing a universal selective pressure. You're only targeting that one nasty thing. So theoretically, the dissemination of resistance will be a lot slower.
So, I mean, the big question is, where does one go from here? When is this thing going to be put into clinical trials to treat Acinetobacter infections? And when's it going to become clinically available?
For preclinical, it's never seen use in patients. So it's still a long road before we have this molecule, you know, positioned for, let's say, even early clinical trials. But we are aggressively pursuing this compound through medicinal chemistry right now. So there are some features of the molecule that we don't love in the context of turning an antibacterial chemical into a clinical antibiotic. So we are structurally modifying the chemical in order to optimize some of the medicinal properties that we want.
And to reduce the side effects. I mean, the question is, I guess, does it have nasty side effects?
Yeah, so right now we're modifying the chemical to improve its solubility, improve its toxicity profile, improve some of its other, you know, adsorption, I'll say anatomic localization properties, so we can ensure that the molecule gets to the right site of infection at a sufficiently high concentration for a sufficient amount of time to clear the infection. Because, you know, we often think of drug discovery as I'm trying to find a drug that can cure X. And that's one property required of a molecule, but there are many properties required to make a lead molecule into a clinical drug, because it has to be super well tolerated, and it has to have good pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic properties, and it has to do the biological thing you want it to do, and, right?
So machine learning, artificial intelligence, deep learning, right? I mean, artificial intelligence gets talked about a lot in the mainstream media, and we hear stories that are scary about how artificial intelligence may be used to replace human beings and could pose an existential threat to humanity if improperly used. It's been in the news recently. But here we have an example of artificial intelligence and machine learning being used to do something incredibly productive and useful in medicine.
Yeah, and I'm not, what do you want to call it, an artificial intelligence philosopher. But I feel like AI it's very clearly a transformative technology that's going to have major implications in, I'll say, like professional and social arenas. It's going to change a lot how we work, how we interact with others, et cetera. And just like every other transformative technology, I feel like it can be used for beneficial things and pretty bad stuff.
So last question, you've discovered a Bowson. A Bowson is an exciting new discovery. What other potentially powerful antibiotics has your laptop spun off and suggested to you, you should try this out? How many of them are there?
I mean, we're running predictions for new antibiotics against different bacterial species all the time. And I'd say at any given time, we have more than a dozen molecules that we're actively looking at in the laboratory to see which ones could be useful and which ones are unlikely to be useful.
More than a dozen.
About that, yeah. And that up and down a little bit. But when appropriately trained and appropriately leveraged, these algorithms are, like I said, they're excellent suggestion generation boxes. And they don't only work for bacteria. I mean, we have an amazing collaboration with a great friend of mine at the University of Guelph, where we've trained an artificial intelligence model to predict new antifungal compounds. That's a project that we recently started a couple months ago, maybe, and we've already had our first glimmer of success in that project.
Because fungal infections are notoriously intractable.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a sneak peek. The early data that we've acquired so far suggests that we have two molecules that are modestly potent, that are structurally divergent from every other known antifungal compound, that work at least in vitro in a dish against Candida. That one's still early. There's a lot of improvement. But the fact that we were able to leverage an artificial intelligence model that's quite similar to the one that we use in bacteria and see, you know, these early signs of potential success in fungal species is super promising. And again, I think that this is going to allow us to, it gives us confidence to start looking for molecules that do, you know, other biological things in other biological systems. So it's, you know, we might do antibacterial work, antifungal work. This will probably work for antivirals and as well as human diseases, right? So the question is not necessarily, will this type of model work for disease X? The question becomes, how do I gather appropriate training data to train a model to apply it to disease X?
John Stokes is an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biomedical Sciences at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Read more about his research at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're appreciating what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about global ecology, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Ancient times, nothing has fascinated human beings more than the diversity of life around them. Aristotle was among the first natural historians. Naturalis Historia by Pliny is the Roman Empire's largest surviving work. The identification and description of living things has come a long way since ancient Greece and Rome. Today, biologists use DNA barcodes to identify living creatures. Here's a story about that. I'm sitting in a booth in a crowded sushi restaurant here in the Netherlands. 25 euros for a small slice of red snapper. That's 34 Canadian dollars. I wonder if it's the real thing or just a cheap substitute.
It's always around one-third it was mislabeled. And it's not random, it's not an accident. You often see the value differences.
Dirk Steinke knows all about food fraud and how to spot it. He works at the Center for Biodiversity Genomics in Guelph, Ontario, home to the world's largest database of DNA barcodes. Among the many practical uses of DNA barcoding, identifying fish species. Steinke tells me about one group he helped out.
They went to their favorite sushi stores in New York City and cut a little piece off of the fish they got served, and then they sent their samples to us, and we did DNA barcoding. And the message back was, yeah, in 40% of what you had there, the label was essentially wrong.
What is a DNA barcode?
Well, a DNA barcode is a small fragment of DNA, characteristic for a species. And it's slightly different in another species, and so on and so forth, which allows you later on, if you probably find a remaining part of something, find a butterfly wing, you could actually take the DNA out of that, and you look for this particular fragment we defined, go back to our database where we collected all this information and try to match it.
A half dozen standardized barcodes exist for different groups of organisms. COX-1 is used to identify animals. Botanists use a chloroplast gene. The